ebook publisher and marketing service company, Just Imagine It, Inc. presents. Get behind me. Now, stay there. Your favorite fun-filled, informative art and entertainment podcast. Available on iTunes, PRX, Podbean, and right here locally in the great Pacific Northwest on KSKQ 89.5 FM Ashland, Oregon. Art and entertainment news and views that you want to know. Today's podcast is brought to you by the fine folks at Downpour.com, the one stop for all your audio and digital book needs. Join the Downpour Audio Club and save up to 50% on digital downloads, exclusive member-only deals and promotions with no commitment, and you can cancel at any time. Only $9.99 per month. And be sure to check out our wonderful book rental program, Fantastic Books for People on the Go. That's downpour.com.
On this episode, we speak with award-winning Canadian singer and songwriter Ed Roman. Author Ruth Noling kills some time with us during her year-long sabbatical to write her memoir about her time spent as a female firefighter and New York Times bestseller A Walk in the Woods in our downpour.com special feature right after the news you want to know.
So 1, 2, 3, take my hand and come with me because you look so fine that I really want to make you mine. Really want to make you mine. 4, 5, 6, come on and get your kicks. Now you don't need the money when you look like that, do you, honey? Big black boots, long brown hair. She's so sweet with her get back stare.
Hello, I'm Charlie Stanton.
I'm Holly Lorian Adams.
I'm Kayla Elrod.
Hi, I'm Sean Mark Nipper.
And I'm Jerry Renfro. Here's a look at our top stories in the art and entertainment world. Project Grand Slam, something I wanted to tell you guys about, PGS as it's known, is the brainchild of Robert Miller, who at the age of 19 trained with Jimmy Garrison, who was John Coltrane's bassist. He's had a 5-decade career playing jazz with pretty much all the greats that have played jazz. The PGS was described by Acid Jazz Magazine as a spectacular mix of jazz, fusion, and rock that combines melody, groove, and great improvisation. They're teaming up now with, I don't know if anybody's watched The Voice, but season 5, the glam diva Kat Robichaud, I think is her name. They worked on an original called New York City Groove and a truly fiery cover of Jimi Hendrix Fire.
Nice.
A good pun.
Yeah.
That was via Yahoo's Music. He did an interview and he was talking about how much he loved Hendrix and that he was fortunate enough that when he was younger, he wandered into the Café Wa in Greenwich Village and some guy named Jimi Hendrix happened to be on the bill. He called it a mind-blowing experience. PGS is going to release their new album, which includes Kat Robichaud on New York City Groove and Fire, as well as a couple tracks they recorded at New York City's Blue Note Jazz Club.
Let me tell you something. If you've never heard... I'm sure most people have heard Jimi Hendrix's Fire.
Yeah,
you know,
once
and,
or twice.
Even if you don't remember hearing it, when you hear it through bars, you'd be like, oh, yeah, I remember that song.
Right.
Yeah.
Da-na-na-na.
For all of our listening audience out there, let's hear a little bit of this dude's Fire, because it is so out of this
hot.
World.
It's hot.
It's hot. It's caliente, baby.
We need that firefighter lady.
Yeah.
Listen here, baby. Your mom ain't home, it ain't my concern. Just play with me and you won't get burned. I have only one itching desire. Let me stand next to your fire. Let me stand next to your fire. Let me stand next to your fire.
It was
right.
Fabulous.
Yeah. Fabulous.
Well, you know who was fabulous?
Who's fabulous?
Lucille Ball.
Lucille Ball will always remain fabulous, but Cate Blanchett
is also fabulous, and she is attached to star in an authorized biopic of Hollywood legend Lucille Ball that Aaron Sorkin is set to write for Escape Artists. So the film will chronicle Ball's 20-year marriage to Desi Arnaz, with whom she starred on the classic TV sitcom I Love Lucy. They had two children and later divorced in 1960. Then she married this guy, Gary Morton, the following year. Related? I don't know. Seems sudden. Anyway, you can't control love. But Lucy Arnaz Jr. and Desi Arnaz Jr. will produce with Escape Artists, whose executive, Jenna Block, will oversee the project like a lord on behalf of Sony-based company. Back to Blanchett. I don't know what I think of her for this role, but she did win her first of two Academy Awards for playing another Hollywood icon, Katharine Hepburn, in Martin Scorsese's The Aviator.
Right.
And with Sorkin's writing, the guy has proven adept at tackling real-life famous people, from Mark Zuckerberg in the Oscar-winning Social Network to Billy Bean and Charlie Wilson. He also wrote the Steve Jobs movie that stars Michael Fassbender. Yeah.
Seth Rogen is a non-funny man.
Yeah, playing Wozniak. Yep. I pretty much want to see it for that.
Can he be not funny?
Is it possible for him?
Some people would tell you he's not funny in all his movies. I would disagree with that.
Right.
So, but I'm looking forward to it. I'm not sure how I feel about Fassbender as Jobs, though. I mean, it doesn't... Yeah, Kutcher looked a lot more like it, but I love Fassbender as an actor, so I'm going to watch it either way.
Well, you got Aaron Sorkin as a director, though, right? And so...
Well,
you got
the writer.
Yeah. Writer, yeah. Okay. So, yeah, there's been, you know, the thumbs up, thumbs down as far as, you know, the real life Steve Jobs, and they didn't go deep enough into the real, you know,
the personal
difficult person he was to get along with. Mm-hmm. But Steve Wozniak actually, but Steve Wozniak actually liked the movie, so that's a plus.
Yeah, you know, I did see the trailer, and Fassbender does a much better job than Ashton Kutcher. Ashton Kutcher's a little too close to the project because he idolized Steve Jobs.
Oh, okay.
And Fassbender doesn't—he doesn't care one way or the other. He's an actor, professional actor, which so is Ashton, but he was happened to be, you know, playing one of his heroes.
I kept waiting for him to say, "Dude, where's my iMac?"
Yeah. But you know, Seth Rogen. Speaking of him playing a Wozniak, right? The real Wozniak saw the movie. And he said that it was spot on. And he said, you know, the guy who plays Steve Jobs, he goes, I've seen all the movies that people have tried to make about him. And he goes, I know him. We've known each other since they were teenagers. Anyway, he said, you know, he goes, this is the only movie I've seen. He goes, where I felt like Steve was sitting in a room while I was watching the movie.
Huh. Oh, wow.
He goes, you know, he goes, and I knew him better than anybody, better than any of his wives.
Right.
And he was married several times. And, you know, and you could see why the family is saying they don't want the movie out because it really tells it like it is.
Yeah, in fact, one of the wives like actively was trying to get it not made.
Wow. Right. One of the wives.
Yeah, she called like a couple of people that were rumored to be attached to it and like, please don't do this movie. Yeah.
So, well, you know what I mean? Because the movie shows him in the light of being a genius and an icon, you know, that everybody really loved. And, you know, he comes back to the company and all these great things. But, you know, what they always leave out is the fact that, you know, he had a child out there that he denied for a lot of years, and he had billions of dollars. And his ex-wife, you know, came to him and said, like, look, man, this is your daughter, and you got all these millions, and you know, we're living on welfare. And he's like, she's not my daughter. He made her drag him through court to prove it was this, and it turned out to be his daughter.
Yeah.
Wow. And he knew all along, and they show things like that in the movie. They show, like, look, man, he may have been, you know, your superhero on this side, but as a man, this is how he really was.
Yeah.
He was more into himself and what he was doing than he was about his 8-year-old daughter who was living on welfare.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, he could have just had somebody from accounting cut some checks and just say, you know, he never would even have known they were gone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I'm listening to that book by Ed Catmull on my downpour.com app, actually.
Nice.
It's called Creativity Inc. And he talks about how he had the computer for Pixar and, you know, George Lucas had it and was going to try to sell it. And then Steve Jobs, the whole ordeal was trying to get Steve Jobs to buy the company. And that was just crazy. So there's a lot of real, you know, input on who this guy Steve Jobs is in that book.
I really enjoy those and hearing about like the early days of Pixar. Because, you know, now we go, oh, Pixar, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. They've got a huge track record, well proven. But there was a time when that was untested, unproven, couldn't get anything made. It was, yep. You know, is this thing going to survive? So it's always nice to, when you see a winner, to see what they went through, you know. And I'm glad for this because, you know, I want to know about that. I want to know about Jobs as a human being, not just the fluffy parts.
Right.
Well, right. You know, here's the thing is like, you know, with Pixar, when you made the comment about Pixar, are they going to make it or not going to make it? They would have made it with or without Steve Jobs. That was one of the luckiest days he ever had.
Oh, yeah.
Is
yeah.
When he ran into Andrew and John Lasseter. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, what they were looking for was money. They didn't care about Steve Jobs, you know, or him running the company right. or anything like that. They were just looking for seed money.
They just needed funding.
Yeah, and he gave them $700 million. And damn. They weren't part of Disney at the time.
Right.
And he funded it. And they had the animation was new that Andrew had just done for Toy Story. And everything was brand new. And when Andrew tells me the story, and he was a Pixar employee number four, behind Lasseter and Steve Jobs. Uh-huh. You know?
Right.
And he was telling me, he says, yeah, he goes, you know, they came to him and said, look, here's a startup. It's new animation. It's a new format. It's a new company. Everything's brand new about this, how we're going to do this. Right. And they wanted his movie. And he said, you know, because he had the new animation. So they did it. And they offered to pay him. They said, you know, we'll pay you so much money up front. Right. Because they had the cash in it. Mm-hmm. He goes, or we'll give you a percentage of Pixar. You and it's a startup. You take your pick.
Yeah.
Because he took the percentage.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just like, dude, he just made so many millions and millions and millions.
Oh, man.
I mean, you know, Pixar went on to do Toy Stories, you know, all the way, you know, and then Finding Nemo and
Wall-E.
Monsters, Inc. and Wall-E yeah. and, you know, all these, you know, Pixar. You know,
that was a smart move.
Yeah.
Yeah, like and it was Alec funny Guinness because when I heard speaking to Steve Jobs, when he was being interviewed and he was still alive, they asked him, did he ever have regrets about being fired from Apple? Mm-hmm. And he said, no. And they go, well, I find that surprising because that was your baby. And he goes, no. The reason I'm not bitter about being fired from Apple is because if I was never fired from Apple, then it never would have been a Pixar.
Yeah.
That's right. True. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, because he was doing his own computer company.
Yeah, it was called Next something. Really.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it failed miserably.
There you go.
Some things, you know, just don't always work out. But we do have a lighter side of, you know, of things to go on to.
Indeed.
John's going to tell us all about Samantha Bee.
Samantha Bee is one of my favorite reporters that was on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. She is freaking hilarious. You know, it's tough being a woman in this heavily dominated male genre of talk shows at night.
Especially tell me about it.
Late show. So, however, if you watch the video on YouTube for the upcoming show that she has coming called Full Frontal, all
right.
They actually had to blur out the enormous scrotum that falls from underneath her skirt as she says, I can hang with the boys. So,
I saw that video and it was so, oh, I'm man. Like, where's this going? Where's this going? You know, and then she's just like, you know, you don't think I got the nuts to hang with these guys?
I've got these. Kaboom.
Oh, my gosh. I was just like, I did not see that coming. And that's the best form of comedy when you don't see it coming. And
yeah.
It's a man.
Yeah. And then she carried him off stage, too. And she's telling people to get out of her way. So that's going to be interesting. Looking forward to that. There's been a huge, you know, shakeup. There's mostly everybody on talk show at night. This is new. You know,
yeah,
Jimmy, and Jimmy Fallon's like the oldest, I think.
Yeah,
but then,
perfect
and
time
gotta,
to try.
They all got to be named Jimmy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Exactly. So I'm looking forward to that. It should be coming out in January, I understand. So.
Well, I'm looking forward to that, too. And I'm also looking forward to a nice massage.
Oh, a nice massage. Maybe from, like, one of the best hands in the business, perhaps?
Yeah, that would work for me.
Yeah. I got a story
best.
Here.
For you.
I got a story here about one of the best in the business, the go-to massage therapist for the Rolling Stones, maybe even Katy Perry and Kanye West. Dr. Dot's first client was Def Leppard, but Robert Plant and Mariah Carey have passed through her healing hands. And a massage with Dr. Dot is a 2-hour journey of intense release, pressure, and pain. And some of the best work in this tri-state area. She's proud to boast to be the best hands in the business. So apparently, Dr. Dorothy Stein, who was dubbed Dr. Dot by Zappa, Frank Zappa,
oh, okay.
has been honing her perfection for over 30 years in massaging some of the most tour bus weary names in the music business. Mm-hmm. As mentioned, we heard Kanye West, Katy Perry, Robert Plant, Mariah Carey, The Stones Also, Sting and Trudy have all had some time on her table. And what she says is attributing to her success is the fact that when she was growing up in her home, they didn't have a television set.
Uh-huh.
So her family was always encouraging her to walk on my back or massage my feet. So she was the little family masseuse. And she says that her family were dedicated Deadheads and her parents would take her to concerts from a young age. She saw at age 12 some bands and went to school the next day in a t-shirt that said titties and beer. And got sent home, of course, with the titties and beer.
I went to Grateful Dead concert and all I got was this t-shirt.
Yeah, that's right. Titties and beer. It was Zappa who gave her the nickname, but it sounds as though almost everyone who's passed through her massage table has been seriously impressed. One of the members of the Rolling Stones encouraged her to stop trading for backstage passes, which she started doing around age 15. She said, if it sounds a little suspect, a 15-year-old girl offering a massage to hang backstage with the bands, she says, have you met me? Presence is very demanding and very clear that she has strong boundaries. That usually she says her clients were scared of her, not the other way around. Wow. I have an aura that says back off. So she was really quite instrumental in a lot of different bands feeling relaxed at the end of their tours. And eventually she opened up what is now known as a Dr. Bot. Over 900 Dr. Bots in over 30 countries globally. Dr. Dot now sends other massage therapists out to do the work, as well as still doing the work herself. She has a really strict policy on how you can get in to be a Dr. Dot Dot Bot massage therapist.
Can you say it five times? You have
dot,
the job.
Dr. Dot's Dot Bots. And she deploys them out to various salons and via her BlackBerry. So,
you know, now,
do they have to wear the titties and bear shirt when they?
Doesn't mention they're here, but they do have to be personally tested by her and/or have gone through someone who's been given a massage by Dr. Dot herself.
Oh, okay.
It's too bad that she wasn't working with Van Halen. Maybe they wouldn't have broke up in the first place. You know.
Well, yeah. Steve Vai and Joe Jackson have both been testers for the Dr. Bot program, and lots of tour managers.
Yeah, you know, that's a fascinating story, you know?
I love that kind of behind-the-scenes stuff, you know, because we see entertainment, we enjoy it, we take it in, and I always love hearing about the process, you know, about how they wrote it or how they, you know, created it or the little things, you know, because they're just people, you know what I mean? And they got tension, they go need a massage and can't just walk into any, you know, massage place.
Yes.
Doesn't Dr. Bot kind of sound like a robot's going to rub you down, though?
Yeah, it did make me
Dots
think of that.
Bots.
To the left, is that good? Harder.
I wonder if they'll sell those on Amazon.
Well, I'd probably
buy one off Amazon.
I mean, they have
it's going to be a new Kickstarter campaign coming up, probably.
I want, like, the whole robot, not just, like, the thing that
do you?
Yeah, I want the whole robot.
Not just the hands.
Like, no.
Like a floating the whole one, thing. Like a little thruster underneath of that.
Well, yeah, I want like the made from the Jetsons.
Well, someday, it looks like Jude someday Law. You'll be able to download it and 3D print it in your home.
There's more to that.
For now, if you're going to download, you got to stick to entertainment and songs and things like that, like Amazon Prime. Anybody here an Amazon Prime member?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, that's what I thought. It's an awesome service. I mean, it's great because of the shipping, and it's awesome because of the Amazon Prime Video. They've inked some great deals. Well, now Amazon is going to do something that no other streaming service has done yet, which is they are going to allow customers in certain countries to start out to download and play videos offline. So if you're not at home and your Wi-Fi, you can download the movie, watch it in your car, hopefully not while you're driving, unless you're me, or, you know, if you're somewhere else where you don't have that connection. So it's going to work for Amazon Video app on iOS and Android and, like, Amazon devices, but not for laptops and PCs, which kind of makes sense, you know.
Of course.
Keep it safe, you know.
Right, because you can't rip or burn
from an iPhone or
something.
So
now
like
when I go camping, I can watch the whole Transformers trilogy. Actually, I would never do that, but I could watch.
That's glamping, anything. By the way.
Well, some
glamping.
Some of the ones they said you could: Downton Abbey, The Good Wife, Girls, and Veep off HBO. Movies like The Hunger Games, Catching Fire, and The Wolf of Wall Street. So this isn't just, you know, like little Timmy's third birthday party video. This is some good stuff here. So you'll.
Who would want?
That was a great movie, by the way.
Yeah, a little
horrible ending.
I love that. The suspense when he was opening that present.
Oh, man. I was just wondering, what was he going to wish for the whole time?
I was not expecting those blocks to come out of that box. One of the executives said, there's no doubt that the way people watch entertainment is changing. Anytime, anywhere, viewing is important. That was Michael Paul, who's the vice president of digital video at Amazon, which, of course, is based in Seattle. So to start off, it's going to be Prime members in the U.S., the U.K., Germany, and Austria.
Are they going to expire?
I didn't hear anything about that. I don't think so. I mean, the idea being, you know, that it is on the device, it's not like a rental. I mean, obviously, if you lose your, if you give up your Prime membership, maybe. I'm assuming they're going to have some sort of DRM in it, you know, to.
No, there's not going to be a DRM in it.
No? Oh, no. Okay.
They don't. What they're doing is they're trying to stay one step ahead of the curve. And the biggest complaint about people is like, you know, when they say you have an iPhone, or most people have an iPhone, you're going to go on a plane trip, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, Wi-Fi sucks on a plane.
It does.
It does.
Yeah. Totally.
Know, Even in the airports, you know, you just got back from a big trip. You know, even in the airport, you know, even if they say it's free for like 15 minutes, long enough for you to get your wallet out.
And,
you know?
Yeah.
But with this, see, it's like, you know, now what they want people to do is they want, because they're making a lot of original content on their services now.
Right.
Yeah, but we did a book called The Man in the High Castle. It's a great book by Philip K. Dick, and they're doing a whole original series on it. It's fantastic. I've seen the first episode. They're going to release it in November.
Nice.
And they do a lot of original content, like a lot of people are. They have the bucks to do original content. And so what they're doing is they're telling people, it's like, look, man, we want you to, you know, continue with our service. So you're going on a plane or train or automobile, or you're going glamping with Sean.
You know, glamping, yeah.
Glamming.
Not glamming. That was the 80s.
Clamps with clamps.
Yeah. Be sure to bring a bottle of water.
Of y'all.
Yeah. And, but what they're doing is they let you download it, right? So when you download the movie, it goes onto your device.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So it's on your device. So when you're in a plane and you want to watch a movie, you can watch a movie. Or you want to watch a TV show, you can watch a TV show. And when you're done with it, man, you just tap on it and it goes right into your Amazon cloud.
Poof.
And so then
it's not taking up space.
Let
me tell you why I like this a lot. I spank my data plan every month.
I was wondering what
and
you were
so
going to say.
So now you can download it with the decent Wi-Fi connection at your home, get all your movies all stacked up, and then when you go traveling, you've got them all there. You're not eating up all that data. So.
That's one of the reasons I listen to audiobooks so much is because I purchase the book or I rent it. It goes onto my device, and I drive a lot, and so I can listen to it.
Yeah.
I'm excited for this because now I can do that same thing.
Now you can drive and
TV
watch movies.
And movies. Right. Like there's a lot of movies that I have still yet to see.
We've all seen The Hunger Games, right?
Oh, yeah.
Hunger Games. So Jennifer Lawrence, that's where she's like most known for. So imagine this. Okay, clear your minds.
All right.
Put in Jennifer Lawrence and put in Amy Schumer and make them sisters.
What about the massage therapist?
Throw in the massage therapist.
And the Dr. Bot.
And the Dr. Bot.
And the Dr. Bot.
With
okay.
The robot massage. And
how about a movie? Should we download a movie?
we're going to be putting it on Amazon Prime for download
In
this imagination. So Jennifer Lawrence, Amy Schumer playing sisters. Yes.
Head explodes.
Yes.
Yeah. Out the side.
This is what's happening. Jennifer Lawrence and the Schumer sisters, Amy and Kim, are almost done writing a script together. So here's what we know. One, it's going to be a comedy. Duh. Uh-huh. Two, Lawrence and Amy Schumer will play sisters. And that's about it. Lawrence dropped the news while chatting with a reporter about The Hunger Games Mockingjay Part 2. Turns out their famous friendship was sparked by fan mail Lawrence sent Schumer after seeing the latter's train wreck. So what she does here is what I do to all of my best friends. She recalls writing in that first fateful message, "I don't know where to get started. I guess I should just say it. I'm in love with you." The Times reports. After just a couple of months of emailing and texting and jet ski adventures, the pair has about 100 pages of a movie set to go. Lawrence talks about how her and Amy were just creatively made for each other. They have different flavors, and it has been the most fun experience of her life, which I can completely imagine. They start the day off on the phone laughing, and then they send each other pages, and they crack up, and life is just completely fabulous.
You know what?
It's awesome.
Amy Schumer, I've always liked her as a comedian, and I've seen her a lot of her stand-up stuff before she blew up and got famous.
Mm-hmm.
And Jennifer Lawrence always struck me, even though the movies she played in the beginning were kind of heavies,
mm-hmm.
But she always struck me as like she's got a really good sense of humor, because when I would see her in award shows
and stuff,
or interviews or something like that, she was always cracking people up, you know, because she was raised, I think she was the only girl, and she had like four or five brothers. So she's in on every joke. She gets it. She rolls with the punches. And so I could see, you know, her and Amy Schumer getting together, because Amy is just so funny.
And outrageous.
Yeah. And Jennifer Lawrence is such a good actress that she can pull it off.
And they kind of, you could see how they could be sisters, actually. Their faces are kind of similar.
Yep. And they have that, kind of straight man.
Amy Schumer would be like an older sister to her.
Wait, what's that?
Amy Schumer would be like her older sister.
Yeah. Yeah, I could see that.
What was that American Hustle that she was in? She was hilarious in that. Did you see it?
American Hustle?
Yeah.
No, I didn't.
What? A Jennifer Lawrence film you did not see?
I haven't seen it.
You haven't seen?
No.
We are on episode 67. I think that is the first time I have ever heard Charlie say, no, I haven't seen it.
Jennifer Lawrence film you have not seen.
No, I have not seen it. You know what? Here's the thing, man.
He likes her painted in blue, I think.
Me and Jenny used to be like peas and carrots. But
she's not on speed dial anymore? What happened?
No, dude, you know what? I listened to Kayla's advice, you know, and I sent her a note, and I said, look, man, I don't know what to say. I don't know how to say this. I just want to start this off by telling you that I love you. I got back a you're a creep message.
Yeah, I was going to say, for you, it sounds kind of creepy. From Lawrence to Schumer, it's cute. From you to Lawrence, not so cute.
And she goes, look at old man.
Hey, but you got a response. That's impressive.
Yeah.
You have enough weight to get a response back.
Well, you know, I think I got a feeling that I'm in the same category as a lot of people that got a cease and desist.
She erased that picture of you on her phone. Now she replaced with Bill Murray.
Right, she did.
I was going to say, if I was ever to get a cease and desist, it would probably be from Bill Murray.
Exactly.
I love that guy.
Exactly. Well, I'll tell you what, there's a new movie with him coming out.
Oh, yes.
Finally, it's been a while since we've had a film, and I just saw the trailer for this. It looks freaking phenomenal.
It does, doesn't it?
Oh, my Lord. I mean, and there is a lot of great talent in this. And they just had a showing of it. And the movie is about him being a
agent.
Yeah, that's what he is. And so it's about music, and it's got...
Or a talent agent.
A talent agent, yeah, okay, there you go. But at the showing, he had a pretty star-studded audience. He had Paul McCartney, Bruce Springsteen, Bon Jovi, John Mellencamp, and another Bill, a big Bill, Bill Clinton.
Wow.
Well, you know, he's a musician too, right?
He is. He plays saxophone.
He plays saxophone. Oh. So pretty phenomenal turnout for this, and I cannot wait to see this film.
I can't believe I wasn't invited, but, you know.
Well, Bruce Willis is also in the film.
Yeah. And Zoe Deschanel and Kate Hudson.
I love Zoe Deschanel, man. She's such a great singer.
Yeah.
You guys thought I was going to say actress or she's so pretty, but she is such a good singer.
Yeah. She and him.
The first time I heard her sing was...
The movie Elf.
In the movie with Will Ferrell.
In the shower.
And it was just like, baby, it's cold outside.
Hey, that was pretty good.
Wait, where is that?
Yeah, you're a pretty good singer, too. That was really good.
Oh, is this my big moment?
That was it.
Yeah, that's it. You got it.
Wait, that's not the right song, though, right?
Yeah, that was right.
Oh, it is the right song. Okay.
Her name's Kayla, everyone, and she's available on weekends to perform for your... Bar mitzvahs.
Got a shower near you.
Your bar mitzvah. I have a limited clientele.
Summer's almost over, so get down to that public pool if you
want
to hear some singing.
It wasn't at all creepy that Will Ferrell was
in the movie. The movie's called Rock the Casbah. It's coming out October 23rd, and it is going to be phenomenal. It's directed by the same guy that directed the movie Toys with Robin Williams.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
LL Cool J.
The trailer and his character reminds me very much so of his character in Ghostbusters. The way that he would kind of use his powers of I'm
gift
so
of the
cool,
gab.
You've got the gift, because, you know, remember he would like interview these people about
the pretty women.
Yeah. Oh, you have definitely extra sensory powers and abilities. Tell me what shape I'm holding up now, you know. Very similar character.
Yeah.
That is. I noticed he has the same haircut as he did in Ghostbusters.
He totally does have that same kind of character coming out in that way.
I can't believe Jennifer Lawrence wasn't invited to this premiere. She's not listed anywhere here.
I think the funniest part about it was I read a little vignette about Bill Clinton meeting Bob Balaban. Mm-hmm. You know, I love Bob Balaban. He's in all the Christopher Guest movies and stuff. And it was really fun. I just imagine, you know, like Bill Clinton going up, you know, going up to Bob Balaban. And I think Balaban said something along the lines, like he introduced himself, like, hi, I'm Bill Clinton. And then Bob Balaban, you know, like, I know who you are. Yeah. I'm a big fan. That's what he said. Actually, that's what Clinton said about Balaban. He's like, he was a big fan. I was like, oh, that's awesome.
Oh, that's great.
And that's your art and entertainment news. Keep listening for Downpour special feature.
Lay there in the street like broken glass, reflecting pieces of the sun. But you're not the flame. You cut the people passing by because you know what you don't like. It's just so easy. It's just so easy. But you and your heart shouldn't.
Ed Roman blurs the lines between pop, rock, folk, and country music genres. His uniquely crafted songs have received regular rotation on more than 100 terrestrial radio stations across North America. He speaks with the president of Just Imagine It, Inc., Charlie Stanton.
Welcome, everybody, to another exciting interview on Get Behind Me Now, Stay There. Today, we are just really honored and pleased to have on Ed Roman. He is an award-winning singer, songwriter, and performer, and multi-instrumentalist, you know. There's two songs I want to talk to you about. One is called Coming All the Way, and the other one is called Jamaica. Now, out of those two songs, you know, do you have a favorite, and how do those songs come about? Because, you know what, for our listening audience, let's hear a little bit of Coming My Way.
I've been looking for a good time. I've been looking every day. I've been waiting for the sunshine. It's been coming my way. And oh, it's been coming my way.
You know, again, you know, tell me a little bit about that, because they're both very different.
Well, yeah, you know, I'm always writing different stuff. I guess, you know, I'm always looking for new ideas, and if it comes from a multitude of different realms, that's okay. And Coming My Way it was like a Dylan-esque number that's very simple to play. I'd always been thinking, you know, okay, campfire tunes and tunes that I used to love to play when we were like at field parties and house parties and joking around and even bastardizing those songs at certain points. That Coming My Way came out the night before a studio session, and we had planned to do something completely different, and I grabbed a pen and the acoustic, and before you knew it, this tune had just sort of popped out. And when Mike Jack showed up the next day, I said, okay, let's do this. And without going into an orchestration with a drum part and a big chorus, I just wanted to keep it bare bones, super simple, and a mantra, which was coming my way, oh, it's coming my way. And, you know, everywhere I go and I talk to people, whether it's in the U.S. or Canada or overseas, everybody's, you know, fighting and struggling and looking for answers for themselves and different things that they're trying to do. And I wanted to have some kind of a simple mantra. And then the idea that, you know, there's this chorus where there's, you know, 36 people all singing that line makes it feel, you know, tribal in a way. And that you would have that experience at a campfire with people singing. And then, you know, lyrically, the verses themselves are trying to just say, encapsulate things metaphorically in the moment. You know, like I could write you out a postcard. I could tell you all the news. Those kinds of things that you'd say to people. Hey, this is what's going on in my life. But it's coming my way. Don't you worry, because I'm working at it.
Yeah, you know, and so, you know, okay, again, you know, for everyone around the world, let's hear now a little bit of Jamaica, and then I want to hear your take on that.
German.
In Jamaica. In Jamaica. In Jamaica.
Now, those
two completely different songs. And what was your thinking on that? Or were you even thinking, or, you know, I don't know, because a lot of writers will say, you know, I thought about this and I just like, you know, I need eight bars here. I need a chorus there. This lyric doesn't sound right. And they really, really, really work it. And then others say, you know what? It just, you know, all the songs on this album came to me in 2 weeks.
Well, that can happen, and sometimes that's like with Coming My Way. It pops out quickly, but then you feel the strength to it, and it belonging to the group of songs that you're working on in the studio, that you're recording. You've already worked on the songs. The arrangements are there. That's why you go to the studio. That's why I go to the studio, and I feel like, okay, these 20 songs or 15 songs or whatever are ready to go. And Jamaica was one of those numbers as well, like, I've been lucky enough to spend some time on the island in the last 3 years and connected with people there that are now family because we're godparents to a child there. And I consider a lot of people there like my family because of the way they treat me and I treat them. So that connection to the island and also feeling regrounded as a human being, because I'll say this, Jamaican culture, as some people think it is dangerous. Well, it's dangerous depending on anywhere you go in the world, for that matter. But
yeah, that's always been fun.
They're very culturally connected still on a verbal and tactical level. So there's anywhere on any given night of the week, you know, especially on a Thursday or Friday, like if you're, there's 15, 20 people all sitting around talking, singing. They're talking about politics, what's been going on. They're listening to music. And it's like sparks are happening. And the thing is, most Jamaicans will have a good cell phone, but a lot of Jamaicans don't have running water. They bathe in rivers. They don't have toilets, you know, and unless you get outside of the resorts and actually spend time with people there, and that's where you actually become really embraced by the culture because you're not afraid. And there's nothing to be afraid about because most Jamaicans will protect you in any circumstance. I've had guys come up to me and say, hey, if something ever happened and here in your little cabin in the jungle, I would go to jail because I would kill them if they tried to do something to you. You know, like, and they're looking after each other on that level, just and like they'll look after you. But that's what I mean. And I mean, for me too, I grew up listening to Bob Marley and Peter Tosh and, you know, Bunny Wailer. All of that to me reinvigorated that feeling of that raw, rustic, Rastafarian reggae feel that I love. And not only that, that I miss, because for that reason, on a musicology level, that feeling of old reggae, that grungy one drop, is not there as much in reggae culture, in Jamaican culture today. So that Jamaica, when I came home, I got behind a drum kit and I wanted to feel more of that, because here we were hanging out and you'd go somewhere and you'd hear and I don't want to hear that when I'm in Jamaica. I want to hear some reggae, like, and that's, I got behind the kit and so there I was playing the one drop, and before you knew it, I just started singing Jamaica over and over again. And when I got that feeling, boom, the lyrics and the idea is, okay, I want to use the Fender Rhodes and I'm going to distort it so it sounds more like a clav, and I'm definitely going to have Hammond organ on it. And it's somehow that melodic harmony background vocal that, you know, you hear like in great tunes that are like, you know, from Bob Marley and the Wailers. And all of that, I was trying to reinvigorate that old rustic feel. You know, it's nice to hear people say, hey, you really captured that feel, because it has that vibe to
it. It did for me, and that's why I wanted to, you know, bring it up, you know, and ask you about it.
And that's the thing, too. Sorry, Ed, is that if you hear also, too, people like Bunny Wailer talk about it, and I was actually lucky enough to meet Bunny when I was there, not this time past, but the time before, that reggae music has many aspects of different stylings in it that create what it is. So you'll hear, say, with a jazzy guitar lick or a rock lick, or there's definitely a funk vibe sometimes. And it's become this cross-melding again, a pooling of ideas that has created this new thing. And it's exciting to do that.
Yeah, you know, we interviewed a guy, Billy David. I don't know if you know of him or not, but he's a musician out of San Diego, California, and he spends a lot of time in Jamaica. He's
okay.
Yeah, and you know, but he was saying things a lot along the same lines as you are, because he says he does different types of music, but that's not all he does. But when he does do it, he goes, I try to do it a little more traditional, you know,
right?
Than what it's progressed to be.
Well, and that's it. And, you know, the first time we went, we stayed at a resort. And you're sitting there, and it's like, string bikini. And I heard inside of 10 days, one Bob Marley song.
Yeah, you know.
And I'm thinking to myself, the man should be on the next note. You know, as far as who he is culturally as an icon there, what he's done for the recording industry, because a lot of people don't realize, aside from Bob's career and him being the icon, the man spent a lot of his own money to build Tuff Gong, to develop it, to be the studio that it is. He went and spent his own money to buy all the record presses so people could punch out vinyl records. He created that entire industry for so many different artists that were put out on Tuff Gong. So Bob, other than, you know, Marcus Garvey and famous athlete, all those, Bob should be like being played everywhere as far as I'm concerned. And not only that, his message, I mean, is so spiritually motivating and personally motivating and, you know, get up, stand up kind of a vibe. Why aren't more people talking about it? I think I know why, but...
Yeah. So where do people find all your music now? Where can our listening audience go out and purchase your music?
Come check me out at edroman.net. You can get the Ed Roman app for free for your iPhone or Android phone. That has a whole bunch of my tunes on there right now that's hooked to my Reverb Nation page, which is another place you should come by. You can also check me out on social media at Ed Roman Music on Facebook, Special Ed Roman on YouTube, Special Ed Roman on Twitter. And you can get my album at iTunes, Amazon, CD Baby. Look for Ed Roman and also look for Special Ed in the Musically Challenged, which are a couple other records that I put out just before these last two. You'll love all the music. It's crazy. It's fun. It's diverse. It jumps all around, and I'm happy to bring it to you all.
Well, you know, that is so cool, man. And I just, you know, again, you know, thank you so much for being on. It's been such a pleasure speaking with you.
Oh, thanks, Ed. Hey, two Eds are better than one.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, man. You know.
To learn more about Ed Roman, visit us on our website at justimagineitinc.com.
Professor Ruth Nolan's memoir as a female firefighter has ignited interest in Southern California. She talks to the president of Just Imagine It, Inc., Charlie Stanton, during her year-long writing retreat in this interview.
Welcome, everybody, to another exciting interview on Get Behind Me Now, Stay There. Today, we have a real treat for you in store, and we have author Ruth Nolan on. Usually, when you interview an author, you interview them after their book comes out. To interview them during the process is just so insightful and delightful. And so for all our listening friends around the world, welcome, Ruth.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Hey, great to have you. And I got to tell you, this new book that you're working on is something. Let's give everybody a little background on it. It's about your experience as a female firefighter, which is very rare. I think it's even so rare these days, isn't it?
Yeah, as far as I know a lot more women are involved probably than in the 1980s when I was working as a wildland firefighter. But I think what's being portrayed in the media in particular, whenever you see pictures of fires, it's always men. And I think, you know, women have just been really underrepresented both in the media but also in the job itself.
Well, you know, I would tend to agree with you on that. I mean, especially in our country, I can't speak for the other countries, but... Firefighters are always perceived as these, you know, macho, strapping men that come in to save the day.
Well, that feeds into the whole fantasy of, you know, chivalry and men, you know, rescuing the heroic effort. But the truth is, a lot of what firefighting is on the wildland scene is a lot of really hard work that involves a lot of intelligence and a lot of training and a lot of the ability to hike. Hiking is a really huge component of a lot of wildland firefighting. And somebody that can sort of hang in there and work really super long shifts and sort of be a team player, I guess, you know, work with a group of people and make it work together. So there's a lot more to it than just the heroic factor, I think.
Well, tell us about the book and how it's coming along, because, you know, I've read, you know, the beginning of it, and I got to tell you, it was fascinating, because I want to compliment you on your writing style. First of all, the whole subject matter is, I wouldn't say it was new to me. You know, we all have read and heard about it, but, you know, to hear like firsthand experience, when I'm reading your writing, it's like, you know, it's like I'm there. It's like, you know, I'm right out there, you know, and I'm shivering, freezing cold, and, you know.
Who would think you're working on a fire, and here you are going hypothermic in the middle of the night. You know, there's so many extremes, and I really appreciate that, because that is really the intent of my book, is to bring readers into the experience without actually having to go out, you know, and do it themselves.
When I was reading it, it was like, you know, it really grabbed me, because, you know, I love the dialogue, and I love the fact that you intermingle the things that are in your surrounding life, you know, into the firefighting itself. And then the time period, which makes it even more, you know, volatile and, you know, extraordinary, because it was almost like unheard of back then.
Yeah, there was definitely a very strange sense of being in a man's world. And I grew up with three brothers, and I was the only daughter in the family. So I think that may have made me a little more comfortable in that kind of setting. But it was extremely strange, because I felt I was in alien worlds anyway, just being flown by helicopter into really remote areas in Nevada and the California deserts, some of the mountain ranges, and not having no sense really of exactly where I was. And just being dropped off a helicopter and having to get out there and work, you know, trying to put a fire out and being afraid and really not having good preparation, you know, very little water and food, and not really just wondering, when's the helicopter coming back? You know, am I going to make it out here?
Right.
Then some of the guys on the crew, you know, were pretty rough and kind of difficult to be with. So I think that even gave me a little more sense of feeling kind of vulnerable out there.
You know, I remember those days, and, you know, all the things that are politically incorrect these days, I mean, were perfectly fine then, you know.
Well,
I'm not saying they're perfectly fine. They never were, but they were perfectly acceptable, you know.
Right. And so I think a lot of men, at least at the time, were very upset about women being on the crew. Some men were very nasty about it. Other men, I think, were very protective. Because several guys, they actually approached me and they were saying, why would you want to be out here? You know, this isn't a good place for a woman.
Right.
You're a really nice girl. You're a college girl. You know, you can do better than this. So it was very interesting, because most of the men did have pretty strong reactions one way or the other, sort of in having a woman in the what they would consider typically the male terrain.
What was your reaction?
Well, gratifying. It's kind of funny, actually, looking back in those days. You know, I was living in a little adobe cabin in the Mojave Desert, and the rent was only $100 a month. I'm sure a lot of people are listening can remember some of those days when life was a lot more inexpensive, and you could get by on a lot less. So going out on fires and getting all kinds of hazard pay and extra hours and overtime, the money was terrific, and I could even save enough to live on during the whole school year.
Wow.
So when I went back to school in the off season, I could, you know, afford to go to school and pay my rent. And so the money, the good, great money at that time in my life was a factor. I also grew up very physically active. I was a really big time tennis player growing up, and actually turned down a college scholarship offer to Occidental College, which I, of course, regret now, because I was tired of tennis. So I think, you know, I was in really great physical condition and really up for the challenge. The physical part, it was hard, but I could do it. It was doable for me. I was already pretty conditioned physically.
Mm-hmm.
I just sort of fell into it. It wasn't like I had an agenda at the time. You know, great job, and it was adventuresome, and I think that was also an appeal to me. Getting to see really remote parts of the West, the Western U.S., areas that maybe no one's ever been to, and certainly not roads or hiking trails, and that was really exotic and very exciting for me. And it remains so, and I want to bring a lot of that sense into the book.
And to be able to write about it, you know, that is the thing, you know, and I know a lot of authors, obviously, because we're in a publishing business.
Well, it's a lot of work. I just worked with a writer at Squaw Valley Writing Conference this past July. I'm not going to name who it was, but he just had the most brilliant quote.
Okay.
He just said, why would anyone want to be a writer? It's a really effed up thing to do. And he just said, I write because I have to, you know, like even people who love to write, people who publish prolifically, I think almost unanimously, many would say that it's just a really difficult, hard thing. And you do it because you're driven to do it. You're not doing it necessarily because it just comes easily to you. But there is a lot of reward in writing. And you look back, yes, I did it. So would you like me to read a little bit from my manuscript?
Sure. Let's do some of that. Let's ride.
So this is from one of the chapters in my memoir. And this is a draft, so it means subject to change before publication.
Okay.
I'm on top of a mountain, Area 51, Nevada. But other than that, I have no idea where I am. Just that I'm in the vicinity of Area 51, home to top secret U.S. military activities and, some say, inexplicable alien sightings and extraterrestrial activities. I'm the only woman on a crew of 12 based out of the Bureau of Land Management Apple Valley Fire Station in the Mojave Desert, a two-hour drive east of Los Angeles. There are only six of us up here tonight. We were flown in from tiny Caliente, Nevada, 180 miles northeast of Las Vegas, hours ago, as dusk was settling in across the sky on the 212 helicopter used for our initial attack flight crew. We are designated as a first responder crew throughout the desert Southwest, on call 24/7 as a small first responder crew when desert wildfires break out. I have no idea what time it is, just that I'm shivering so hard, lying here on the rocky ground next to the rough fire line I helped cut earlier this evening, that I've woken up. I can hear a few of the others snoring, and it seems that I'm the only one who's awake. This is one of my very first assignments. Lightning started this fire, and we've managed to keep it down to burning less than 5 acres by cutting down blazing pinyon pine trees and clearing juniper bushes away with chainsaws and Pulaski. The Pulaski is a specialized two-headed steel tool with an axe on one side and a grubbing instrument on the other, designed specifically for fighting wildfires in terrain such as what we're seeing up here. I look up, half asleep, feeling stoned and dazed. Glass-cut stars beam down at me. There's no light at all except for a very faint smudge of light on the faraway horizon, which I can detect when I lift my head off the ground. I realize that the lights must be from Las Vegas, and I wish I were there instead of out here. Wish I were there tucked into a hotel room or playing roulette, sipping beer with my boyfriend Zach. So, how's that?
That's great. That's fantastic. And you know what? For all of our listeners out there, you know, I've read, you know, much more, and I tell you, it just draws you in.
I feel like at this point in my life, in addition to being in the fires, that I was having a lot of very fearful and dangerous things going on in my personal life at the time too, which are revealed as the book goes along, and just how to deal and negotiate with all that and kind of transform, you know, to pull through that and find the strength to do so and come out in a better place on the other side is a big part of my book.
Well, you know what? We're certainly looking forward to it, you know, when it comes out. And it's been such a pleasure talking with you, Ruth. I have to tell you, man, I've been a big admirer of yours for quite some time.
Thank you so much.
And, you know, thank you so much, you know, for coming on to the show. And hopefully we'll see you up here in Ashland again. And we'd love to have you come in the studio and do some filming. And I know everyone was anticipating your arrival.
Well, I'll come up and help work on some of those fires up there, right?
Okay.
I'm not even qualified anymore. It always gives me a little rush. I want to go work on a fire when I see it. And that has never left me, that sort of adrenaline rush that I think all firefighters experience that. So thank you so much. It's really been enjoyable talking to you.
Thank you.
To learn more about Ruth Nolan, visit us on our website at justimagineitinc.com.
Once it starts, it never stops. Discipline, it's all I'm not. But now myself, you listening. Why can't I say just what I want? You don't know anything. No, you don't know anything about me.
A New York Times bestseller. The Appalachian Trail stretches from Georgia to Maine and covers some of the most breathtaking terrain in America. Majestic mountains, silent forests, sparkling lakes. If you're going to take a hike, it's probably the place to go. and Bill Bryson is surely the most entertaining guide you'll find. He introduces us to the history and ecology of the trail and to some of the other hardy, or just foolhardy, folks he meets along the way, and a couple of bears. Already a classic, a walk in the woods will make you long for the great outdoors, or at least a comfortable chair to sit in and read.
Then there is the little-known family of organisms called hantaviruses, which swarm in the micro-haze above the feces of mice and rats, and are hoovered into the human respiratory system by anyone unlucky enough to stick a breathing orifice near them. By lying down, say, on a sleeping platform over which infected mice have recently scampered. In 1993, a single outbreak of hantavirus killed 32 people in the southwestern United States. And the following year, the disease claimed its first victim on the AT when a hiker contracted it after sleeping in a rodent-infested shelter. All AT shelters are rodent-infested. Among viruses, only rabies, Ebola, and HIV are more certainly lethal. Again, there is no treatment. Finally, this being America, there is the constant possibility of murder. At least 9 hikers, the actual number depends on which source you consult and how you define a hiker, have been murdered along the trail since 1974. 2 young women would die while I was out there. For various practical reasons, principally to do with the long, punishing winters of northern New England, there are only so many available months to hike the trail each year. If you start at the northern end, at Mount Katahdin in Maine, you must wait for the snows to clear in late May or June. If, on the other hand, you start in Georgia and head north, you must time it to finish before mid-October, when the snows blow back in. Most people hike from south to north with spring, ideally keeping one step ahead of the worst of the hot weather and the more irksome and infectious of insects. My intention was to start in the south in early March. I put aside 6 weeks for the first leg. The precise length of the Appalachian Trail is a matter of interesting uncertainty. The U.S. National Park Service, which constantly distinguishes itself in a variety of ways, manages in a single leaflet to give the length of the trail as 2,155 miles and 2,200 miles. The official Appalachian Trail Guides, a set of 11 books, each dealing with a particular state or section, variously give the length as 2,144 miles, 2,147 miles, 2,159 miles, and more than 2,150 miles.
Short of doing it yourself, the best way of escaping into nature is to read a book like A Walk in the Woods, says the New York Times. Bill Bryson is the New York Times best-selling author of At Home, A Walk in the Woods, The Lost Continent, Made in America, The Mother Tongue, A Short History of Nearly Everything, winner of the Aventis Prize, and various other works. Born in Des Moines, Iowa, he now lives in England, where he has worked for both The Times and Independent and written for most other major British and American publications. For more information about top-selling titles from this award-winning company, go to downpour.com.
Get Behind Me Now, Stay There is Just Imagine It, Inc. presentation and was recorded in the Blackstone Audio, Inc. studios in Ashland, Oregon. If you'd like more information about this show, or if you or someone you know would like to be featured, please call 541-708-0525 or visit justimagineitinc.com. I'm Holly Lorian Adams.
I'm Jerry Renfro.
I'm Kayla Elrod.
I'm Sean Mark Nipper.
And I'm Charlie Stanton, and we like you, so be sure to like us on Facebook. And remember to get behind me.
Now stay there.